look at your older child and demand, "What did you do this time?" But when your younger child says, "No, Dad, I just fell and hurt my knee," you realize that what seemed obvious wasn't accurate at all, and that shark music has once again led you astray. Because your older child has played too rough in the past, you assumed that was the case this time. Few parental actions will hinder connection faster than assuming the worst and reacting accordingly. So instead of making assumptions and operating on information that may be faulty, question what seems obvious. Become a detective. Put on your Sherlock Holmes hat. You know, Sherlock Holmes, the Arthur Conan Doyle character who declared, "It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data." Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. When dealing with our children, it's dangerous to theorize before we have data. Instead, we need to be curious. We need to chase the why. Curiosity is the cornerstone of effective discipline. Before you ever respond to your child's behavior, especially when you don't like it, ask yourself a question. I wonder why my child did that. Let this lead you to other questions. What is she wanting here? Is she asking for something? Trying to discover something? What is she communicating? When a child acts in a way we don't like, the temptation will be to ask, "How could she do this?" Instead, chase the why. When you walk into the bathroom and see that your four-year-old has decorated the sink and mirror with wet toilet paper and a lipstick she found in a drawer, be curious. It's fine to be frustrated, but as quickly as possible, chase the why. Let your curiosity replace the frustration you feel. Talk to your daughter and ask her what happened. Most likely, you'll hear something that's totally plausible, at least from her perspective, and probably hilarious. The bad news is that you'll still have to clean up the mess, preferably with the help of your daughter. The good news is that you will have allowed your curiosity to lead you to a much more accurate and fun, interesting, and honest answer about your child's behavior. The same would apply when your second grader's teacher calls to discuss certain impulse control problems your son is displaying. She tells you he's not respecting authority because he has begun making noises and inappropriate comments during class reading time. Your first reaction might be to initiate a "that's not the way we behave, mister" conversation with your son. But if you chase the why and ask him about his motivation, you might discover that Truman thinks I'm funny when I do that, and now he lets me stand by him in the lunch line. You'll still need to do some redirecting and work with your son on appropriate ways to navigate the difficult world of playground politics, but this way you'll be able to do so with much more accurate information about your son's emotional needs and what's actually driving his actions. Chasing the why doesn't mean that we should necessarily ask our children, "Why did you do that?" every time a disciplinary situation arises. In fact, that question may imply immediate judgment or disapproval rather than curiosity. Further, sometimes children, especially young ones, may not know why they are upset or why they did what they did. Their personal insight and awareness of their own goals and motivations may not be very skilled yet. That's why we're not advising you to ask the why. We're recommending that you chase the why. That's more about asking the why question in your own mind, allowing yourself to be curious and wondering where your child is coming from in this moment. Sometimes the behavior we want to address won't be as benign as lipstick decorations and potty humor. Sometimes our child will make decisions that lead to broken objects, bruised bodies, and damaged relationships. In these cases, it's all the more important that we chase the why. We need to be curious about what drove our child to throw the screwdriver in anger, to strike another child, to spit out venomous words. It's not enough simply to address the behavior. Human behavior is purpose-driven most of the time. We need to know what's behind it, what's causing it. If we focus only on our child's behavior, her external world, and neglect the reasons behind that behavior, her internal world, then we'll concentrate only on the symptoms, not the cause that's producing them. And if we consider only the symptoms, we'll have to keep treating those symptoms over and over again. But if we put on our Sherlock Holmes hat and chase the why, curiously looking for the root cause behind the behavior, we can more fully discover what's really going on with our child. We might find real reasons for concern that need to be addressed. Maybe we'll learn that our assumptions were false. Or maybe we'll discover that this bad behavior is an adaptive response to something that's too challenging for the child. Perhaps, for example, your child is faking an illness each day before PE class, not because he's lazy or unmotivated or oppositional, but because that's his best strategy for dealing with the intense self-consciousness he feels when doing something athletic in front of his peers. By wondering what our kids are trying to accomplish, and by allowing them to explain the situation before we rush to judgment, we're able to gather actual data from their internal world, as opposed to simply reacting based on assumptions, faulty theories, or shark music. Plus, when we chase the why and connect first, we let our children know that we're on their side and that we're interested in their internal experience. We say to them, by the way we respond to each situation, that when we don't know what actually happened, we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Again, that doesn't mean turning a blind eye to misbehavior. It just means that we're looking to connect first by asking questions and by being curious about what's behind the external behavior and what's happening inside our child. Connection principle number 3. Think about the how. Listening for shark music and chasing the why are both principles that ask us to consider our own and our child's inner landscapes during a discipline moment. The third connection principle focuses on the way we actually interact with our kids. It challenges us to consider the way we talk to our children when they're having trouble managing themselves or making good decisions. What we say to our kids is, of course, important. But you know that just as important, if not more important, is how we say it. Imagine that your 3-year-old isn't getting into her car seat. Here are a few different hows for saying the exact same what. With eyes wide, big gestures, and a loud, angry tone of voice, get in your car seat! With clenched teeth, squinted eyes, and a seething tone of voice, get in your car seat. With a relaxed face and a warm tone of voice, get in your car seat. With a wacky facial expression and a goofy voice, get in your car seat. You get the idea. The how matters. At bedtime, you might use a threat. Get in bed now or you won't get any stories. Or you could say, if you get in bed now, we'll have time to read. But if you don't get in bed right away, we'll run out of time and have to skip reading. The message is the same, but how it's communicated is very different. It has an entirely different feel. Both hows model ways of talking to others. Both set a boundary. Both deliver the same request, but they feel completely different. It's the how that determines what our children feel about us and themselves, and what they learn about treating others. Plus, the how goes a long way toward determining their response in the moment, and how successful we'll be at helping produce an effective outcome that makes everyone happier. Children usually cooperate much more quickly if they feel connected to us and when we engage them in a pleasant and playful exchange. It's the how that determines that. We can be much more effective disciplinarians if our how is respectful, playful, and calm. So those are the 3 connection principles. By checking for shark music, chasing the why and thinking about the how, we set the stage for connection. As a result, when our kids behave in ways we don't like, we have the opportunity to connect first, prioritizing the relationship and improving the odds of a successful disciplinary outcome. Now, let's look at some specific connection strategies. The no-drama connection cycle. What does connection actually look like? What can we do to help our kids feel felt and know that we're with them right in the middle of whatever they're going through as we engage in the discipline process? As always, the answer will change based on your individual child and your personal parenting style. But most often, connection comes down to a four-part cyclical process. We call it the no-drama connection cycle. It won't always follow the exact same order, but for the most part, connecting with our children when they're upset or misbehaving involves these four strategies. The first, communicate comfort. Connection strategy number one, communicate comfort. Remember that sometimes your kids need your help calming down and making good choices. It's when their emotions get the best of them that we have the most discipline issues. And just as you'd hold and rock or pat a baby to calm her nervous system, you want to help your children calm down when they need it. Words are useful, especially when you're validating feelings. But most nurturing takes place non-verbally. We can communicate so much without ever talking. The most powerful nonverbal response of all is one that you probably do automatically. You touch your child. You put your hand on her arm. You pull her close to you. You rub her back. You hold her hand. A loving touch, whether subtle like the squeeze of a hand or more demonstrative like a full warm embrace, has the power to quickly diffuse a heated situation. The reason is that when we feel someone touch us in a way that's nurturing and loving, feel-good hormones like oxytocin are released into our brain and body, and our levels of cortisol, a stress hormone, decrease. In other words, giving your kids loving physical affection literally and beneficially alters their brain chemistry. When your child, or your partner, is feeling upset, a loving touch can calm things down and help you to connect, even during moments of high stress. Touch is only one way we communicate with our children non-verbally. We're actually sending messages all the time, even when we never utter a word. Think about your typical body posture when you discipline your kids. Do you ever find yourself leaning over your child with an angry look on your face? Maybe you're saying, in a scary tone of voice, "Knock it off!" or "Stop that this instant!" This approach is essentially the opposite of connection, and it's not going to be very effective at calming your child. Your escalated response will intensify her emotions even further. Even if your intimidation results in your child appearing calm, she'll actually be feeling anything other than calm. Her heart will pound in response to the stress because she is afraid enough to shut down her emotions and hide her feelings in an attempt to keep you from becoming more angry. Would you approach an upset animal in a similar fashion? If you had to interact with an angry-looking dog, would you approach it with an aggressive body posture and demand that the dog knock it off and calm down? That wouldn't be very smart, nor would it be effective. The reason is that it would communicate to the dog that you're a threat, and the dog would have no other option than to react, either by cowering or by fighting. So instead, we're taught to approach a dog by putting out the back of our hand, crouching down low, and speaking with a soft, reassuring voice. In doing so, our whole body communicates a message. I'm not a threat. In response, the dog can relax, calm down, feel safe, and then approach and engage. The same process occurs with people. When we feel threatened, our social engagement circuitry can't turn on. We have trouble engaging our upstairs brain, the part that is thoughtful, makes sound decisions, and has the capacity for empathy and regulating our emotions and body. Instead of calming down and making good decisions, we simply react. This reaction makes sense, evolutionarily speaking. When the brain detects threat, the downstairs area immediately goes on alert and becomes highly activated. Functioning in this more primitive mode allows us to keep ourselves safe by being hypervigilant, by acting quickly without thinking, or by going into fight, flight, freeze, or faint mode. It's the same with our kids. When emotions escalate and we respond by communicating threat through the frustrated or angry look on our face, our mad tone of voice, our intimidating posture, hands on hips, finger wagging, leaning forward, their innate biological response will be to activate their downstairs brain. However, when their caregivers communicate, "I'm not a threat," then the reactive, fighting, act before thinking downstairs part of the brain quiets, and they can move into a mode of processing that allows them to handle themselves well. So how do we communicate, "I'm not a threat," to our kids, even in the midst of escalating emotions? By connecting. One of the most effective and powerful ways to do this is to put your body in a posture that's the opposite of imposing and threatening. Lots of people talk about getting at a child's eye level, but one of the quickest ways to communicate safety and the absence of threat is to get below the child's eye level and put your body into a very relaxed position that communicates calm. You see other mammals doing this to send the message, "I am not a threat to you. You don't need to fight me." We recommend that you try this below eye level technique the next time your child is upset or out of control emotionally. Put your body in a chair, on a bed, or on the floor so that you are below your child's eye level. Whether you lean back or cross your legs or open your arms, just make sure that your body communicates comfort and safety. Your words and your body language combine to convey empathy and connection, telling your child, "I'm right here. I'll comfort you and help you." You'll comfort her nervous system and calm her down, just as you did by holding and rocking her when she was a baby and needed you. We've been thrilled by how many of the parents to whom we've taught this technique report that this approach is magic. They can't believe how quickly their children calm down. What amazes the parents just as much is that putting their bodies into this relaxed, non-threatening posture actually calms down the parents themselves as well. They report that this approach works better than anything else they've tried to keep themselves calm, and it leads to the best outcomes in how well they handle the high-stress situation. Obviously, you can't get down on the ground if you're in the car or walking across the street, but you can use your tone of voice and posture, as well as your empathic words, to communicate the absence of threat, so you can connect with your child and produce a calm in both of you. Nonverbal communication is so powerful. Your child's whole day can turn on something you're not even cognizant of, something that's not even said. Something as simple as your smile can soothe a disappointment and strengthen your bond. You know that moment when your child does something she's excited about, like kicking a soccer goal or reciting a line in a play, and she looks for you in the crowd. Your eyes meet and you smile, and she knows that you're saying, "I saw that and I share your joy." That's what your nonverbal connection can do. Or it can do just the opposite. We can communicate, I'm exasperated. You wear me out. I can't stand you right now, and I blame you for making things so hard on me. Or, I am furious with you and could explode at any moment. Be afraid, very afraid. This is how people act when you do something wrong. Or, you'd better do what I say and now. I don't care how you feel or what the circumstances are. Power, control, and aggression are how I get what I want. The fact is that we send all kinds of messages, whether we intend to or not. And if we're not careful, our nonverbals can undermine the connection we're aiming for in a high-emotion disciplinary environment. Crossing the arms, shaking the head, rubbing the temples, rolling the eyes, a sarcastic wink at another adult in the room. Even if our words are expressing interest in what our child is saying, there are plenty of ways our nonverbals betray us. And if our verbal and nonverbal messages contradict each other, our child will believe the nonverbal. That's why it's so important that we pay attention to what we're communicating without saying anything at all. When we do, we'll be more likely to communicate the messages we want to communicate to our kids. For instance, what you're sharing with me right now is crucial, more important than anything going on around us, even more important than anything I want to say. Or, I know you had a hard day at school, and although I don't have just the right words to say, I'll always be here for you. Or, I think you're fantastic, and you fill me with joy. I'm not exactly happy about the decision you made, but I love you even when you mess up. We're not saying there won't be high emotion disciplinary moments where you get completely exasperated with your kids, or that they won't misread something you're communicating and get upset. Mistakes will be made on both sides of the relationship, of course. Likewise, sometimes you may decide it's appropriate to use nonverbal communication to help your kids monitor themselves and rein in their impulses when necessary. But the bottom line is that we can be intentional about the verbal and nonverbal messages we're sending, especially when we're trying to connect with our children in a difficult moment. Simply nodding and being physically present communicates care. Connection strategy number 2, validate, validate, validate. The key to connection when children are reactive or making bad choices is validation. In addition to communicating comfort, we need to let our kids know that we hear them, that we understand, that we get it. Whether or not we like the behavior that results from their feelings, we want them to feel acknowledged and sense that we're with them in the middle of all those big feelings. Put differently, we want to attune to our children's inner subjective experiences, focusing our attention on how they are experiencing things from their point of view. Just as in a duet, both instruments need to be tuned to each other to make good music, we need to tune our own emotional response to what's going on with our kids. We need to see their mind and recognize their internal state, then join with them in what we see and how we respond. In doing so, we join them in their emotional space. We deliver the message, I get you, I see what you're feeling, and I acknowledge it. If I were in your shoes and at your age, I might feel the same way. When kids receive this type of message from their parents, they feel felt. They feel understood. They feel loved. And as a huge bonus, they can then begin to calm down and make better decisions, and hear the lessons you want to teach them. Practically speaking, validation means resisting the temptation to deny or minimize what our kids are going through. When we validate their feelings, we avoid saying things like, "Why are you throwing a fit about not having a play date? You were at Carrie's all day yesterday." We avoid pronouncing, "I know your brother tore your picture, but that's no reason to hit him. You can just make another one." We avoid declaring, "Stop worrying about it." Think about it. How does it make you feel when you're upset and maybe not handling yourself well, and someone tells you that you're just tired, or that whatever's bothering you isn't that big a deal, and you should just calm down? When we tell our kids how to feel and how not to feel, we invalidate their experiences. Most of us know better than to directly tell our kids they shouldn't be upset. But when one of your children reacts intensely to something that doesn't go his way, do you ever immediately shut down that reaction? We don't mean to, but parents can often send the message that we think the way they feel about and experience a situation is ridiculous or not worthy of our acknowledgement. Or we inadvertently communicate that we don't want to interact with our kids or be with them when they have negative emotions. It's like saying, I will not accept that you feel how you feel. I'm not interested in how you experience the world. It's a way of making a child feel invisible, unseen, and disconnected. Instead, we want to communicate that we'll always be there for them, even at their absolute worst. We are willing to see them for whoever they are, whatever they may feel. We want to join with them where they are and acknowledge what they're going through. To a young child, we might say, you really wanted to go to Mia's house today, didn't you? It's so disappointing that her mom had to cancel. Especially with older children, we might identify with what they're going through, letting them know that even though we're saying no to their behavior, we're saying yes to their feelings. That made you so mad that Keith tore your picture, didn't it? I hate it when my stuff gets messed with, too. I don't blame you for being furious. Remember, the first response is to connect. Redirection will come, and you'll definitely want to address the behavioral response. But first, we connect, which communicates comfort and almost always involves validation. Usually, validation is pretty simple. The main thing you need to do is simply identify the feeling at hand. That really made you sad, didn't it? Or, I can see you feel left out. Or even a more general, you're having a hard time. Identifying the emotion is an extremely powerful response when a child is upset, because it offers two huge benefits. First, helping her feel understood calms her autonomic nervous system and helps soothe her big feelings, so she can begin to put the brakes on her desire to react and lash out. Second, it gives the child an emotional vocabulary and emotional intelligence, so she herself can recognize and name what she's feeling, which helps her understand her emotions and begin to regain control of herself so that redirection can occur. As we put it in the previous chapter, connection, in this case through validation, helps move a child from reactivity to receptivity. After acknowledging the feeling, the second part of validation is identifying with that emotion. For a child or an adult, it's extremely powerful to hear someone say, I get you. I understand. I see why you feel this way. This kind of empathy disarms us. It relaxes our rigidity. It soothes our chaos. Even if an emotion seems ridiculous to you, don't forget that it's very real to your child, so you don't want to dismiss something that's important to her. I recently received an email that reminded me that it's not only young children who need to be validated when they're upset. I heard from a mother in Australia who had listened to a radio program where I talked about the power of connection. Part of the mother's email went like this. Right in the middle of listening, I received a call from my 19-year-old daughter who was having a meltdown. She was in pain from a physical therapy session. Her bank account was in the negative, and she didn't understand a lot of today's business law lecture. She was stressed about her exam tomorrow, and work wanted her to come in 2 hours early. My first reaction was to say, first world problems, suck it up, princess. But after hearing your interview, I realized that while indeed they were first world problems, They were her first world problems. So I said that I was sorry for her bad day, and did she need a mummy hug? It made so much difference. I could hear her take a breath and relax. I told her I loved her, that her dad and I would fund her textbooks, which is why her bank account was in the negative, and that after her exam tomorrow, I'd treat her to her favorite noodle soup at Bamboo Basket. She was much more relaxed after the call, thanks to how I responded. So often we react harshly without realizing the impact it may have. Even when our kids are mostly past the tantrum stage and we have a calm life with them, there's so many times throughout the day to put these ideas into practice. Notice this mother's well-executed validation of her daughter's experience. She didn't invalidate her daughter's feelings by denying them, minimizing them, or blaming her. Instead, she acknowledged the bad day and asked whether she needed a hug. Her daughter's response was to take a deep breath and relax. Not because her parents were going to help her financially, but because her feelings were acknowledged and identified. Because they were validated, then the actual problems could be addressed. So when your child is crying, raging, attacking a sibling, throwing a fit because his stuffed dog is too floppy and won't sit up properly, or demonstrating in any other way that he's incapable of making good decisions at that moment, validate the emotions behind the actions. Again, it might first be necessary to remove him from the situation. Validation doesn't mean allowing someone to get hurt or property to be destroyed. You're not endorsing bad behavior when you identify with your child's emotions. You're attuning to him. You're tuning your instrument to his so that you two can create something beautiful together. You're meeting him where he is, looking for the meaning, the emotional undercurrent behind his actions. You acknowledge and identify what he's feeling, and in doing so, you validate his experience. Connection strategy number 3, stop talking and listen. If you're like most of us, you talk way too much when you discipline. This response is actually funny if you think about it. Our child has gotten upset and made a bad decision, so we think, I know, I'll lecture him. He'll calm down and make a better choice next time if I make him sit still and listen to me drone on and on about what he's done wrong. Want to turn your kids off, especially as they get older? Explain something, then keep making the same point over and over. What's more, talking and talking to an emotionally activated child is not the least bit effective. When her emotions are exploding all over the place, one of the least effective things we can do is to talk at her, trying to get her to understand the logic of our position. It's just not helpful to say, he didn't mean to hit you when he threw the ball. It was just an accident, so you don't have to get mad. It doesn't do any good to explain, she can't invite everyone in your whole school to her party. The problem with this logical appeal is that it assumes the child is capable of hearing and responding to reason at this moment. But remember, a child's brain is changing, developing. When she's hurt, angry, or disappointed, the logical part of her upstairs brain isn't fully functioning. That means a linguistic appeal to reason isn't usually going to be your best bet for helping her gain control over her emotions and calm herself. In fact, talking often compounds the problem. We know because we hear it from the kids we see in our offices. Sometimes they want to scream at their parents, please stop talking, especially when they're in trouble and already understand what they've done wrong. An upset child is already on sensory overload. And what does talking to him do? It further floods his senses, leaving him even more dysregulated, feeling even more overwhelmed, and much less able to learn or even hear you. So we recommend that parents follow the kids' advice and stop talking so much. Communicate comfort and validate your child's feelings. It really hurt that you didn't get invited, didn't it? I'd feel left out too. Then close your mouth and listen. Really listen to what she's saying. Don't interpret what you hear too literally. If she says she's never going to get invited to another party, this isn't an invitation for you to disagree or to challenge this absolute statement. Your job is to hear the feelings within the words. Recognize that she's saying, I've really been thrown for a loop by this. I didn't get invited, and now I'm afraid about what this says about my social standing with all of my friends. Clue in and chase the why as to what's really going on inside your child. Focus on her emotions, letting go of the shark music that prevents you from being fully present with her in the moment. No matter how strong your desire, avoid the temptation to argue with your child, lecture her, defend yourself, or tell her to stop feeling that way. Now is not the time to teach or explain. Now is the time to listen, just sitting with your child and giving her time to express herself. Connection strategy number 4, reflect what you hear. With the first 3 strategies of the no drama connection cycle, we communicate comfort, we validate feelings, and we listen. The 4th step is to reflect back to our children what they've said, letting them know we've heard them. Reflecting their feelings returns us to the 1st strategy, since we're again communicating comfort, which can lead us through the connection cycle once more. Reflecting what we hear is similar to the 2nd step, but it differs from validation in that now we focus specifically on what our children have actually told us. The validation stage is all about recognizing emotions and empathizing with our kids. We say something like, I can tell how mad you are. But when we reflect our children's feelings, we essentially communicate back to them what they have told us. Handled sensitively, this allows a child to feel heard and understood. As we said, it's extraordinarily calming, even healing, to feel understood. When you let your child know that you really grasp what he's telling you by telling him, I hear what you're saying. You really hated it when I told you we had to leave the party. Or, no wonder that made you mad. I'd feel angry too. You take a huge step toward diffusing the high emotions at play. Be careful, though, with how you reflect feelings. You don't want to take one of your child's short-term, temporary emotions and turn it into something bigger and more permanent than it really is. Let's say, for example, your 6-year-old becomes so upset about her big brother's constant teasing that she begins yelling over and over again, "You're so stupid and I hate you." Right there in your backyard, with the neighbors hearing it all, thank goodness Mr. Patel is mowing his lawn, she repeats the refrain nonstop, seemingly dozens of times until she finally falls into your arms, crying uncontrollably. So you initiate the connection cycle. You communicate comfort, conveying your compassion by getting below her eye level, holding her, rubbing her back, and making empathic facial expressions. You validate her experience. I know, honey. I know. You're really upset. You listen to her feelings, then you reflect back to her what you're hearing. You're just so angry, aren't you? Her response might be a return to yelling, "Yes, and I hate Jimmy," with her brother's name drawn out into another scream. Now comes the tricky part. You want to reflect for her what she's feeling, but you don't want to reinforce this narrative in her mind that she actually hates her brother. A situation like this calls for some careful tiptoeing so that you can be honest with your daughter and help her better understand her feelings, but keep her from solidifying her momentary emotions into longer-lasting perceptions. So you might say something like, "I don't blame you for being so mad. I hate it when people tease me like that, too. I know you love Jimmy and that you two were having so much fun together just a few minutes ago when you were playing with the wagon, but you're pretty mad at him right now, aren't you?" The goal with this type of reflecting is to make sure your child comprehends that you understand her experience and in doing so, to soothe her big emotions and help calm her inner chaos, so that she can move back into the center of her river of well-being. But you don't want to allow a feeling that's simply a momentary state, her anger with her brother, to be perceived in her mind as a permanent trait that's an inherent part of their relationship. That's why you give her perspective and remind her of the fun she and her brother were having with the wagon. One other advantage that comes with reflecting our children's feelings is that it communicates that they have not only our love, but our attention. Parents sometimes assume that it's bad when a child seeks our attention. They'll say, "He's just trying to get my attention." The problem with this perspective is that it presumes it's somehow not okay for a child to want his parents to notice him and pay attention to what he's doing. In reality, though, attention-seeking behavior is not only completely developmentally appropriate, it's actually relational. Attention is a need of all children everywhere. In fact, brain imaging studies show that the experience of physical pain and the experience of relational pain, like rejection, look very similar in terms of location of brain activity. So when we give our kids attention and focus on what they're doing and feeling, we meet an important relational and emotional need, and they deeply feel connected and comforted. Remember, there are plenty of ways to spoil children, by giving them too many things, by rescuing them from every challenge, by never allowing them to deal with defeat and disappointment. But we can never spoil them by giving them too much of our love and attention. That's what the connection cycle does. It lets us communicate to our kids that we love them, that we see them, and that we are with them no matter how they behave. When we turn down the shark music, chase the why, and think about the how, we can communicate comfort, validate, listen to and reflect feelings, and support our kids in ways that create the kind of connection that clearly communicates our love and prepares them for redirection.
Chapter 5. 1-2-3 Discipline. Redirecting for today and for tomorrow. Roger was working in his garage when his 6-year-old Katie stormed outside, angrily calling out, "Dad, can you do something about Allie?" Roger soon learned that Katie was upset because her friend Gina, who had come over for a playdate, had become completely enamored with Katie's 9-year-old sister, Allie. For her part, Allie was apparently happy to monopolize the playdate, leaving her younger sister feeling left out. In addressing the situation with his older daughter, Roger saw various alternatives. One would be simply to tell Allie she needed to give Katie and Gina some time by themselves, since that was the plan for the playdate after all. There would be nothing wrong with this approach, but by making the call and imposing his own agenda on the situation, Roger would bypass the important process that would allow Allie to use her upstairs brain. So instead, he went into the house, called his older daughter aside, and simply initiated a brief conversation. They sat on the couch, and he put his arm around her. Considering Allie's personality and temperament, he decided to begin with a simple question. "Roger, Gina's having fun playing with you, and you're really good with younger kids. But I'm wondering if you noticed that Katie's not too happy about Gina giving you all of her attention." Allie, defensively sitting up and turning toward her father, "Dad, I'm not even doing anything mean. We're just listening to music." Roger, "I didn't say you're doing anything wrong. I'm asking whether you've noticed how Katie is feeling right now." Allie, "Yeah, but that's not my fault." Roger, "Sweetheart, I totally agree that it's not your fault. Listen to my question. Do you see that Katie isn't happy? I'm asking whether you've noticed." Allie, "I guess." In that one admission, we see evidence that Allie's upstairs brain had become engaged in the conversation, if only a little. She was actually beginning to listen and think about what her father was saying. At this point, Roger could target which part of the upstairs brain he wanted to appeal to and exercise. Not by telling Allie what she should think or feel, but by asking her to consider the situation for herself and to pay attention to what someone else was experiencing. Roger, why do you think she might be upset? Allie, I guess because she wants Gina all to herself. But that girl came into my room. I didn't even ask her to. Roger, I know, and you may be right that Katie wants Gina all to herself. But do you think that's it exactly? If she were standing here and told us how she felt, what would she say? Allie, that it's her playdate, not mine. Roger, that's probably pretty close. Would she have a point? Allie, I just don't see why we can't all listen to music together. Seriously, Dad. Roger, I get it. I might even agree with you, but what would Katie say to that? Allie, that when we're all together, Gina just wants to play with me? And with that question, the empathy broke through. It was only an emerging awareness. We can't expect a huge lifetime movie moment where a 9-year-old girl is moved to tears out of her compassion for her little sister's emotional pain, but it was a start. Allie was, at the very least, consciously beginning to consider the feelings of her sister, which, if you have young children, you know is no small parental victory. From there, Roger could direct the conversation so that Allie would think more explicitly about Katie's feelings. Then he could ask for Allie's help in coming up with a plan for handling the situation. Maybe we listen to one more song, then I get ready for my slumber party. And in so doing, he would further engage her upstairs brain by having her plan and problem solve. Initiating a redirection conversation like this won't always be successful. There will be times when a child will be unwilling or even unable to see a different perspective, to listen and consider the feelings of others. Roger might end up simply telling Allie she needs to find something else to do, just as Liz had to make the call when her daughter wouldn't give in about who was going to drive her to school. Or maybe he could play a game with all three girls, making sure everyone feels included. But notice that when he needed to redirect, Roger didn't immediately impose his own sense of justice on the situation. By facilitating empathy and problem-solving, he gave his daughter a chance to exercise her upstairs brain. The more we give kids the opportunity to consider not only their own desires, but also the desires of others, and practice making good choices that positively impact the people around them, the better they'll be at doing so. Does a conversation like this one between Roger and Allie take longer than simply separating the girls? Of course. Is it harder to do? Yes, probably. But is collaborative and respectful redirection worth the effort and extra time? No question about it. And as it becomes your default, it actually makes things easier on you and your entire family, since there will be fewer battles, and you'll be building your child's brain in such a way that less and less often will you even have to address misbehavior. 1-2-3 discipline. In this chapter, we want to take a closer look at the concept of redirection, which is actually what most people mean when they think of discipline. Redirection is how we respond when our kids do something we don't like, such as throwing something in anger or when they're not doing something we want them to do, like brush their teeth and get ready for bed. After we've connected, how do we address uncooperative or reactive kids? Redirecting them toward using their upstairs brain so they can make more appropriate decisions that become second nature over time. As we've said, no drama discipline is about connecting and being emotionally responsive to our children while aiming for the short-term goal of gaining cooperation now as well as the long-term goal of building our child's brain. A simple way to think about redirection is to take a 1-2-3 approach that focuses on one definition, two principles, and three desired outcomes. You don't need to memorize every detail of the approach. Just use it as an organizing framework to help you focus on what's important when it comes time to redirect your kids. One definition. The place to begin when thinking about redirecting our kids toward better behavior is with the definition of discipline. When our children make unwise decisions or can't manage their emotions, we need to remember that discipline is about teaching. If we forget this simple truth, we'll go off course. If discipline becomes about punishment, for example, we can miss the opportunity to teach. By focusing on the consequences of misbehavior, we limit the opportunity for children to experience the physiological and emotional workings of their inner compass. One mom told us the story of finding a small box of crayons when she and her 6-year-old were cleaning her daughter's room. They had been shopping for school supplies a few days before, and her daughter had fallen in love with these particular crayons. The mother had not bought the crayons, but her daughter had slipped them into her pocket anyway. The mother said that when she found the crayons, she decided to ask her daughter about them directly. When the little girl saw the crayons in her mother's cupped hand and the mother's look of confusion, her eyes got wide and full of fear and guilt. In a moment like this, the parental response is going to largely determine what a child takes away from the experience. As we explained in Chapter 1, if the parent's focus is on consequences or punishment, and she immediately yells, spanks, sends the child to her room, or takes away an upcoming opportunity she's excited about, then the child's focus will immediately shift. Instead of having her attention on that uh-oh feeling bubbling up inside of her, or instead of thinking about the decision she made when she took the crayons from the store, all of her attention will focus on how mean or scary her parent is for punishing her in this way. She may even feel like a victim who is somehow retroactively justified in swiping the crayons. Instead, this mom offered a disciplinary approach focused on teaching rather than immediate consequences. She gave her daughter time to sit with and be aware of that uncomfortable, valuable, natural guilt she was feeling as a result of having taken something that wasn't hers. Yes, guilt can even be healthy. It is evidence of a healthy conscience, and it can shape future behavior. When the mother talked to her daughter, she knelt down, getting below eye level as we discussed a few moments ago, and an endearing conversation ensued during which the 6-year-old at first denied taking the crayons, then said she didn't remember, and then, with the mom patiently waiting, eventually explained that her mother had nothing to worry about because "I waited till the sales lady with the big hair wasn't looking" to put the crayons in the pocket of her shorts. At this point, the mother asked lots of questions that encouraged her daughter to think through concepts she hadn't yet considered. Do you know what taking something that doesn't belong to you is called? Is stealing against the law? Did you know that the woman with the big hair in the store spent her money to buy those crayons so she could put them in her store? In response, the daughter dropped her head further, her bottom lip started to come forward, and big tears began to fall. She obviously felt bad about what she had done. As she quietly cried, the mom pulled her close, not distracting her or stopping the process of what was already happening naturally, but joining with her as she said, "You're feeling bad about it." The daughter nodded, and the tears continued. The mom could comfort and be with her daughter in this beautiful moment where the discipline process continued naturally without the mom even doing or saying anything. The mother held her and allowed her to cry and to feel and after a couple of minutes, she helped wipe away the tears and encouraged her daughter to take a deep breath. Then they continued their conversation briefly, talking about honesty, about respecting others' property, and about doing the right thing, even when it's hard. By initiating this collaborative, reflective dialogue and allowing discipline to naturally arise simply by orienting her daughter's attention to the internal guilt she was already feeling, rather than just laying out instant consequences, the mother allowed her daughter to give her upstairs brain some exercise by considering her actions and how they affected others, and by learning some basic lessons about ethics and morality. Then they made plans for how best to return the crayons to the sales lady with the big hair. So instead of immediately giving consequences and saying something like this, "I can't believe you took these. Go to your room." Try initiating a conversation. So as you discover the crayons, you might say, "Can you tell me about these?" No drama discipline is all about teaching. And that's what this mother focused on. She allowed her daughter to thoughtfully experience the feelings and thoughts associated with her decision to take the crayons. By allowing the child's own internal experience to remain at the forefront of her mind, rather than shifting the emotions into anger over a punishment handed out, she allowed her daughter's brain not only to become aware of that inner discomfort, but also to link it to the experience of making poor choices, in this case, stealing. Again, being punitive or doling out consequences, especially when we're angry and reactive, can be counterproductive because it distracts our children from the physiological and emotional messages of their own conscience, which is a powerful force in developing self-discipline. Remember, neurons that wire together, fire together. And we want our kids to experience the natural linkage between making a bad decision in one moment, then feeling guilty and ill at ease the next. Because the brain is driven to avoid experiences that produce negative sensations, the aversive feelings that naturally arise within a child when she does something that violates her inner conscience can be very fleeting in her conscious mind. But when we help her become aware of these sensations and emotions, they can become the important basis for ethics and self-control. This self-regulation or executive function that develops can then engage even when her parent isn't there or when no one is looking. This is how she internalizes the lesson on a synaptic level. Our own nervous systems can become our very best guides. Different disciplinary situations will obviously call for different parental responses. This mother responded based on what lesson her daughter needed in that particular moment. In other circumstances, she might respond differently. The point is simply that once we've connected with our kids in a disciplinary moment and it's time to redirect, we've got to keep in mind the importance of awareness and helping the brain learn. Reflection with a child helps them become aware of what's happening internally, and that optimizes learning. When we keep in mind the definition of discipline, we realize that sharing awareness helps learning occur. Discipline is all about teaching to optimize learning. Two principles. We also want to follow two main principles when redirecting our children, allowing those two principles to guide whatever we do. These principles, along with the specific strategies that follow from them, encourage cooperation from kids and make life easier for adults and kids alike. Principle number one, wait until your child is ready. Remember what we said in chapter 3? Connection moves a child from reactivity to receptivity. So once you've connected and allowed your child to come to a place where he's ready to listen and use his upstairs brain, then it's time to redirect, not before. One of the most self-defeating parenting recommendations we hear from time to time goes something like this. When a child misbehaves,